And now, Chad, how come you're late, Chad? Any news? Top time in Serbia?
No, I've been here the whole time. I just keep getting knocked off the call.
You don't know why?
No, it's just tactical.
Okay, so you know about the article we're going to do?
Yeah, I have it open.
Okay, so we've got this, you know, we explained Tucker is an agent of the outrage complex, the industrial outrage complex. Let me bring up my article. So we looked at the journalist, supposedly a female, supposedly wrote all the stuff. We don't know if she did writing. We don't know anything, right? You don't really know anything. You have to remember that. Post-Information Society. So the industrial outrage complex sounds like an interesting, potentially a Bob-supported outlay, or I could say office hours support, though I'm not sure. Greg, he watches this stuff too much. Greg watches Tucker for a year now or something, totally into Tucker.
I only watch it on YouTube, that's all.
Yeah, but you watch it. That's the sin.
Yeah, because he's the only good guy on.
Well, your good is what we're going to criticize here, okay? Your idea of good.
Yeah.
So here's what she says. Outrage sells, and no one knows that better than those taking full advantage of your outrage to profit directly. Now, that's a kind of common sense statement. A lot of people, even aren't even sophisticated, will say, well, all this news noise is just people then getting sucked into venting their anger, right? You agree that it's not a big, profound thing to say this opening point, outrage sells, and no one knows that better than those taking full advantage of your outrage to profit directly. What do you think? That's obvious?
Not profound, no.
Right. It's never been a secret that content that evokes strong emotions is going to drive more engagement. But outrage is perhaps the most active one of all. Strong emotions, still a bland statement, which you get from a journalist writing for Washington Post and that. So this is non-information.
Wait a minute here. There's a difference between being outraged about something that is factual and being or reasonably factual or believable and being outraged by something that's a complete lie. I mean, people got outraged.
I mean, there's no judgment yet about the outrage, just noting, observing that it drives more engagement than other reactions. Engagement, like in hard social media numbers.
What would they be doing that wouldn't involve, that might not involve outrage? I mean, what would they be talking about where outrage would not be even possible?
I think the next sentence mentions such an instance, a cute puppy video.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand. I mean, I think it's a ridiculous thing to even say, because, I mean,
ridiculous, Greg, that people are upset with too much outrage.
Yeah, because what do they want broadcast? What exactly are they expecting to be seeing when they tune into a news program? I mean, even if you had, look at Sean Hannity or something goes on and he starts saying, I mean, he'll be involved in some outrage. Oh, you know, these leftists or the China's coming to get us and all this. Yeah, they're doing that, but the thing is, and that's part of it, but the thing is that a lot of these people are just putting forward abject lies with no foundation. The difference with Tucker was that if outrage was involved there, if people would become outraged because of something he said one way or another, either outraged because Tucker is exposing something, and people go, that's terrible that this is going on in this great country of ours, it shouldn't be going on, I'm outraged. Or it's outrage at Tucker for even talking about it, for even mentioning it. Like you should.
Okay.
You
okay. Great. Point taken. Well, we'll put that. That's you. You've registered that to you. Okay. Let's see what the article says.
All right.
Okay. So it says a 2017 NYU study of over 500,000 tweets found that tweets using hyphen or quote moral emotional words unquote like Evil or Steel were more likely to go viral. You might like a cute puppy video. You might even share it, but anger is going to earn your fierce commentary. Hence, I use the term industrial outrage complex. Now, she has an asterisk down at the bottom, or oh, just down below a bit. The industrial outrage complex is roughly defined by me as a system that utilizes and amplifies outrage as a currency that's used to help bolster slash exploit the social and political impact and or economic gains of for-profit media and political institutions. So she's saying it's all about money. So she says, hence I use the term industrial outrage complex, which hungers for your fuming words. The more you share and interact, the more others react. Thus, there's more engagement, powering a feedback loop, fueling the creation of more outrage porn, continuing the cycle. Outrage porn, there's a term you've heard before. Continuing the cycle. Now, that's been going on since the Telegraph, okay? But it's increased with the multimedia, multi-extensions, so it's 24/7. What is the appropriate response? Throw out your TV. Throw out your radio. Why put up with this? Because you're being duped into thinking that the issues politicians grab from all this outrage are the important issues. The real important issue is, do we need all this fucking information bombing at us and distracting us from basic concerns, which could be Marxist concerns or humanist concerns, literacy concerns, poverty concerns, the usual ancient concerns. So there's a huge distraction. She is not saying that yet. She is saying that there's a lot of this stuff and it's a cycle, which is kind of obvious. There's nothing new yet, other than she's come up with a name, Industrial Outrage Complex. So, Greg, I'm saying that it's a post-information society. Me and Kroger have been saying this for 30 fucking years, and that is the real issue, which, of course, came from McLuhan, and maybe Joyce is spinning its weight. Let's take a break from this. What? But people won't. And so McLuhan says in the preface to Interior Landscape in 1969, must we continue to mow down the Kennedys to show that the hot politics of hot industrial culture don't work on a cool medium of TV? Well, they do work, but on a content profit level, industrial level, but they don't work whatever people think television is supposed to give you. Why have TV? So people are causing this. They are doing it to themselves. And I want to see if she addresses that. You know? Is she going to address you, the consumer? Even reading this commentary makes you guilty. No, does anybody dare do that? Because a lot of people don't watch the news. They don't fall into the outrage response, and they enjoy whatever programming is entertainment stuff, supposedly called entertainment, right? They do that. But maybe, as McLuhan said, bad news, you need a lot of bad news to sell the good news, and the good news is the advertising. Or the programming. Many people have said that the sitcoms are just the daily entertainment of family-oriented TV is increasingly one big ad for white male-dominated society, images of that kind of society. All right? Now, that's a bit weakened with the decentralization. You got black entertainment and all that, but they still follow the same bland mode. So I want to see, she says in a little paragraph what is obvious, and let's see what she does with it. So she says, the politicians, going down below the quote there, the politicians get to grab onto this anger and build their campaigns on top of it, and the media companies get endless content from your manipulated emotions. More normal common sense. And the more they serve it up, the angrier you get. Oh, is that right? I get angry? After all, the algorithms are showing you more and more outrage content. They show you more of what makes you mad and less of what makes you happy. Well, actually, people are watching a lot of happy stuff, regular entertainment. They give you a skewed sense of reality by prioritizing the type of content that will engage you more over the kind that will engage you less. And thus, the industrial outrage complex thrives on. Now, when I'd be embarrassed to write common sense stuff like this. How about you people?
Right.
There's nothing you know, we don't need this. Well, is she going to, maybe she's going to figure out a solution here. All right? So she says, meanwhile, you get angrier and more desensitized. You like people less. I think Bob Dylan said that in 1965, for fuck's sake, 60 years ago. You like people less.
Yes.
It's easier to dehumanize others. The world seems worse. Your views and positions become more extreme. You react quicker and less rationally. You probably become a worse person, frankly. Yeah, you become a fundamentalist religious Republican. That's what happens. You become a goddamn Christian. She won't go that far, but that needs to be said. Much of the bad news of the last 40 years has made televangelism a big business. Anybody disagree with that?
No, sir.
Yeah, it's obviously the end times. But it's just, if you just turned off TV, it wouldn't be the end times. So, outrage erases nuance. Okay, nuance, that's literacy, I think, right? That's visual bias, or that's the ability to read and appreciate
right.
the subtle points of the mind.
And not being a cartoon.
Yeah, not being a cartoon. And, you know, cartoons got even more unnuanced in the design that Greg complains about. Like, they don't have the subtlety of drawing in the animation like they used to. When you agree, Greg,
right.
that even cartoons lost visual nuance.
Yeah.
Greg, you better be still here. Don't drop
yeah,
off
yeah.
And go fuck Catherine.
I'm thinking about what to say. I was thinking about it today earlier that animation, if we want to talk about that, which is the moving picture cartoon, they reached an incredible level of, very involved and very sophisticated in the 1930s. All the way through the 1930s, they got more and more and more sophisticated, and that carried on into the 40s and I suppose into the 50s to a great extent. And now they're sort of reversing. It's since about 1960 television era. And when the American economy and inflation started to kick in a big way, I think that the way for a country to be able to make involved, amazing animation, which we saw from all sorts of different studios, from Walt Disney, Warner Brothers, MGM, Paramount, etc., etc. I mean, really involved work, time-consuming, animated cartoons, sort of humorous films, generally. For a country to be able to do that is a major feat. Actually, it's an art form. It's like the Renaissance or something with artists and involving technology as well, such as it was, you know, film and so on. It's I think it was a statement about America, that America was able to put vast amounts of effort into these cartoons, let alone films and things like that, other films, live action films. It was just almost boasting about their power. And then as America's power started to wane, starting around, you know, I'd say sometime in the 50s, certainly into the 60s, it all had to retract. And we're seeing it now. I mean, really, when you see a cartoon like a South Park, I mean, it's visually, I mean, I'm not complaining about South Park. I think it's a good show, but from an animation point of view, it looks bankrupt. It's almost referencing the bankruptcy of the United States, of having these little, you know, cutouts sort of shifting around.
I thought of South Park as well when I was bringing up the cartoon thing and Bob talked about the nuance in animation, because it's like, I find that they are, I'm like, honestly, frequently impressed by how expressive the animation on South Park manages to be in its kind of
clunky way. But yeah, their icon is definitely the opposite of the sort of the kind of bouncy walking and the different, like, just how expressive and detailed and elastic and the dynamic the gestures were in the golden age, that it, like, seems that no one can ever recreate. And South Park is almost the opposite of that.
But I agree with you that they are able to do things on South Park that make, they can make the characters very evocative, even through the movement. Even the movement is kind of interesting. And how they apply personality through it. So within a very restricted medium that they're working with, or technique that they're using. So, I mean, it can be done, but you look at things like Family Guy or The Simpsons even, there's a bit of a bankruptcy to it. You know, and then you see all the things that are aping those things, and it's, I mean, no one's doing anything expressive, as you say, well, because it costs too much money.
Great.
It's impossible.
I don't want to get too distracted. So
yeah.
You made your point.
I agree.
She says outrage erases nuance, McLuhan would say maybe the cartoons got more clunky because it became less a visually oriented society. It became acoustic and tactile. So there would be a formal reason on the sensory level why it got less nuanced. It was more literate people in the 30s, 40s to dig that. Their eyes were better. Now, when she says outrage erases nuance, her nuance might be iconic or television-oriented nuance, like you're talking about, and regretting where it's gone. Or she might mean literary nuance. So there's different nuances. But it is nuance in general. She's saying outrage erases. It requires podcast hosts and media personalities to put on a performance of sorts. The most popular amongst them come in the strongest, full of conviction. There's no balanced middle ground weighing of arguments. That doesn't sell. Also, there's less time as the media got more various in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. The competition to keep it, the people's attention, right? To keep people listening, you need to not become slow and literary and, quote, visually book-oriented logical. So that's going to be diminished due to the form. Anybody want to say anything about that?
That sounds about right.
Okay, so but she's keeping on the money level about profits. That doesn't sell. I was listening, Ed posted an interview with Mike McCormick, a guy who'd been, the stenographer for Obama, maybe Bush, Obama, Trump. That means he transcribed telephone conversations or maybe, press conferences and that stuff. He had a lot of interesting things to say about the ugliness. He now has a Substack column. I've heard of the name, but I don't know much about him. But he is exposing a lot in the Biden laptop and all that from his experience as a guy in the White House and knows what was allowed to be public and what wasn't. And there are many transcripts that have not been released. But the two people interviewing him were the two old people, and man, did they sound stupid. They're very crude in their speech, total amateurs, and a New York sophisticate or L.A. sophisticate would not like them. And I noticed, even I was irritated by them. But they kept asking questions that blew Mike McCormick's mind. He says, wow, that is a damn good question. And they were questions that you don't anticipate. So there was, I'm used to smooth-talking professionals, and they don't do anything. This one looked pretty and smooth. And here's these crude bumpkins who are actually producing more interesting information, even though they don't sound very good. So there's a problem. If you need to watch TV a lot, you want it to be soothing to your ears, so you don't like crude amateurs on there stumbling around. And that's... efficiency on the style or the content level that comes in with professionalism, right? Which is a disadvantage if they are too concentrating on getting their speech correct and pleasant. So that's just a personal thing I noticed. I instinctively didn't like these dummies at first, but I had eventually had to be impressed at how many times Mike McCormick, who's getting interviewed a lot now, was impressed with their questions. So
who is this again? Who is this person?
Mike McCormick was, he said, a stenographer for three administrations. He transcribed the daily activities of press conferences and phone calls, public phone calls with among the staff and administration and ministers and meetings. He transcribed everything, and the White House determined which was released or not. And he says there's a lot of incredible stuff that you can't get unless you go through the Freedom of Information Act. So he's looking forward to that when it gets freed up, because he knows where to go, because he was there for three administrations. He knows what was hidden. And he knows interesting stuff was in there. So his was a non-glamorous job, you know, in the White House. And so he's finding a lot. He got the laptop. A guy gave him the Hunter Biden laptop, and he can't believe the corruption. And he remembers he went with Biden when he was vice president and transcribed a lot of stuff in his travels around the world. And he now remembers the stuff that was pretty weird, pretty risky. And he's waiting for the FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, stuff to come out so he can go find it, because he knows where it is, because he was on those trips. All right? So that's an interesting position, right? Of course, the Department of Justice ain't going to do anything about it, no matter what he finds. Okay, but he is appalled at what's on Hunter Biden's computer that he has seen so far. Okay. Okay, that doesn't sell. Balance middle ground weighing of arguments. Do I want someone to be balanced? No, I wanted a consequence of information. But I'm not going to get a consequence of information in the society. As a matter of fact, we've actually come to a Bob attitude of it is a post-information society, and the Department of Justice and the whole Biden ignoring media. They don't care if you find what you find. Bullshit. It's all post-information. We're not going by anything you find out there. Right? It's actually being implemented, a post-information attitude. Nobody can get the Department of Justice to look at Sidney Powell stuff or anybody else while Tucker Carlson smears Sidney Powell because he has to keep a certain middle of the road kind of respectability for a kind of literate truth about something.
But Bob, she never came up with anything.
Oh, yeah? You haven't heard one bit of it. She's waiting. When she comes out, she'll topple everybody.
The thing is that if she's going to come out with it, she should wait. She shouldn't be crowing about things.
No, she could crow. She's got the stuff.
Yeah, but yeah.
So what? She knows the game, Greg. She's already done. You read her book? She's already written a book on it. She was exposing all the, she knows the Post-Information Society. So she's waiting for the right time with my guidance. She's following my guidance in this matter. Okay? So blame me. And my buddies. Right? Okay. So So on goes Catherine saying, anger as an emotion is real and raw, but too often we are manipulated by some other forces into feeling it. The feeling itself might be authentic, but we are puppets on a string. So she's repeating herself. The puppeteers, however, are more often than not dishonest manipulators. No, they are providing entertainment. What's dishonest about that? They know what they're doing, and they know exactly how to be effective. See, they're dishonest if you think you can get some truth out, and that there is some truth in the situation. But the truth is, the actual truth, the existential truth is, nobody wants real literate truth that would stop the machine because they want to keep getting entertained. And they don't need to be informed of what the news is or what the truth is because they got entertainment happening. So we are guilty of this. We are the ones doing this to ourselves. This is Biko's third phase. You know, there was the era of gods. And then the era of heroes, and now the democracy, the democratic era, the little man. And that's what we are. We're little men, walling around in our own self-reflection. They know which tweet will start a flame war. What, Brian?
The era of the gaping mob.
M-A-W-B. Ma and mob.
Yeah.
They know which tweet. No wonder people think there are black holes in space. There's black holes in media for ever since electricity came in.
Yep.
That's the gaping mob. So we have to fill in the tactile effect of TV. They know which tweet will start a flame war or earn them followers. They have the metrics to track it. They know which topics to bring up on their shows. That's why they consistently milk them, even though there are more important issues to discuss that affect people's lives more profoundly and directly. Like the one about the Information Society that she hasn't mentioned yet. And will a journalist mention it? I doubt it. The industrial outrage complex isn't there to serve society. It's there to line the pockets of its masters and to service their goals. This is, what do they call the Parents Association, the monitors of schools?
PTA?
Yeah, PTA. What's that? Parents and Teachers Association?
Yeah.
McLuhan wrote way back there that the PTA was Big Brother. Big Brother wasn't a bunch of Nazi, you know, the Ukrainian ex-Germans or ex-Nazis from the World War II, guys clumping around in the streets. That's not Big Brother. Big Brother went inside and then came back out in the mixed media post-TV era as the PTA. They make sure everything's respectable. And what else
do they do? Where is that quote? That's actually a good one.
That's in the Washington Post about, I have in my archives, Washington Post about 1972. I don't think it's in any inventory. It's just a lucky find, you know?
Because people, this is like almost a spooky prediction, you know? Now people, he was like saying, all news is fake, and then he's saying, the PTA is Big Brother. It's like, well, people have caught up. Some people see, you know, the people, vigorously participating in parent-teacher meetings to dispute what's being taught in class as the tip of the spear of fascism, you know? There are people who would say that.
There would be? I don't think so.
Yeah, there are. That it's like, oh, yes, the fascists are mobilizing to, you know, shut down our... you know, liberatory education efforts.
Now, a lot of the criticism of McLuhan in the 60s was he wasn't political enough. He didn't deal with the political issues like maybe Big Brother. He pointed out that Big Brother was obsolete in 1934. Orwell was a doofus. But they didn't know those quotes. Those were in his letters and that, and nobody had access to the letters yet. But in the 70s, he did a little bit of top-down analysis, like saying that the PTA was Big Brother. So he did throw in political stuff. But he knew if he started off that way, he wouldn't have got the attention. So he said in 1951, I'm going to needle the somnambulist and distract the triggermen. The triggermen are the deep state. You're going to distract them with the idea that the medium is the message, not the content, get attention, and then bring in the other levels. So it's an incomplete appraisal of McLuhan if you only know the 60s McLuhan. You'll see his whole project. So he was political.
Yeah.
And then he knew the real political issue was the media environments themselves. That was more politics than anything that went on in them in terms of scandals and stuff. So she says the industrial outrage complex isn't there to serve society. It's there to line the pockets of its masters and to service their goals. For political consultants, getting people mad is profitable business. Nothing new there. That's a kind of cynicism that pops up once every 5 years. A column like that will happen. You know what I'm saying? This is a rare column. They don't, journalists don't like mentioning the obvious ground. Like McLuhan said, the fact that advertising is good news and that you need a lot of bad news, end times news, to make the advertising palatable, because advertising upsets people because it gives you things that you got to sell what you have and get the new stuff. So it's actually bad news, advertising is. And what's called negative gloom and doom news, it's good because it gives people the emotion of surviving. So it's always contradictory and convoluted and Mobius stripping on itself. So she says, perhaps too, we move down a bit below the picture, there's some echoes here of how more than 1,000 years ago, in parts of Europe, masses would gather around to hurl rotten food and insulting words at the heads of those who violate the moral codes of their society. They're saying there's echoes of that. It was seen as having some value, setting the standards for our society. The practice of pillory was eventually outlawed as it was seen as being too cruel. That was the reason. But what could have been, why was it seen as cruel? Because people got dainty with the literate printed book effect. They got a little sensitive about this crude, tactile, kinetic lifestyle of the medieval period. They weren't as brutal as we have retrieved brutality in sports and
right.
wars and everything
it's like,
today.
It's like the literacy or the, you know, that it allowed us to grow. We developed the kind of identity that was so wounded by that the pillory caused wounds that would never heal to the new sensitized identity that we didn't have before. You could publish a pamphlet and be a author talking to his public, you know? If the author talking to their public was suddenly thrown in the stocks for some crime, pilloried, well, their writing career would be over. Like, it wouldn't just be a localized punishment, it's kind of a forever punishment with certain types
right.
of identity, like the more pamphlet publishing author literate identity.
And
that
we had lost
stained
our
forever.
John,
the wound never healed.
We had lost our John Cage sensibility. You know, people, pre-literacy, it's a rough life, swearing is common, or whatever guttural language would be, it's more tactile. People are rougher, and we look back on the medievals as a time of disease and crudity, and people didn't wash at all, and all that kind of stuff. Those were values that came in with literacy, with the printed book effect. Not alphabetic literacy,
right.
but the printed book. So we were made more detached. It was a visual detachment
yeah.
that made the other senses diminish. Now, culture was trying to balance that by having new arts that piped up the ear. That was opera. Bringing this bellowing, screaming, that stimulated the visually deadened ear. But there still was a polite society dynamic that did not exist in the medieval period. So I say that John Cage trained people for getting ready for a tactile, kinetic, proprioceptive, guttural acoustic society that was coming in from the 60s on. We were going medieval, retrieving that sensibility, but through electric virtual technology. So she cites a little history here, a little token of some literacy here with this historical fact of the pillory. She doesn't know why the standards forced a change in the pillory. The practice of pillory was eventually outlawed as it was seen as being too cruel, but then it was never monetized. Now it's part of our economic system, in addition to being a political weapon. But, as a journalist blind to the effects of media, she should add a third dynamic, economic, political, and media dynamics. McLuhan should be common, the lingua franca of sensibility.
Yep.
Everybody should know
yep.
it and have those terms. Just like they
yeah.
have Marx. They know about capitalism and the third phase, the proletarian takeover, the basics of Marxism.
Right. And the thing, you know, where she, the part where she said, you know, nothing new there, like, well, yeah, that's what happens when an analysis that happened decades ago doesn't get completely ignored. You
yeah.
know? Like, there was a time when it was new. It was maybe still pretty new, that kind of consciousness, at least in a popular sense, around when McLuhan was writing The Mechanical Bride, the idea that it'll outrage cells and something,
yeah.
something. Like, the big newspaper publishers knew it, you know, I'm sure that wasn't Barnum's specialty, but I'm sure he knew it, you know, that wasn't new then, but it was newer. But like, hell, like, we've had, enough time has gone by that McLuhan's basic insights, it should be the same thing. Nothing new about that.
And obviously, it makes us
obvious retrieval
because of
this thing. Nothing new there. McLuhan said it 50 years ago. But no,
right, but they would use McLuhan. You'd say this is a retrieval of medieval sensibility, not put it in easy Gutenbergian, which is economics and political, right? And she's
right.
putting it back in, and that, as a writer, is all she knows. So she says, outrage or anger does have a role. It can be a motivating force for change. What the hell? We got change going on 24/7 in content change upsetting people, the endless processing of the latest scandal and stuff or whatever is being told about black holes or AI. That's what's changing us. What is the kind of change she wants? That would be capital C change. It can be a way to stand up to injustice and wrongs. That's a Greg Duffel point of view. Yes, we could get this outrage and do something. But no, we don't have time to. But it's one thing when it comes organically from the people. Whoa. And another when it's a matter of top-down manipulation. See, that's too much Gutenberg class warfare. Gutenberg created class warfare, heightened up the differences in classes. And so you're projecting that into medieval, into our present. Retrieval of the Dark Ages and medieval, where the class distinctions aren't as stark anymore, because everybody gets to watch the same TV programs, because television is a global democratic wealth basket of enjoyment or titillation that you're, no matter where you are on the class spectrum, you're subject to what they produce in New York or L.A. Everybody gets the same content. I remember seeing a play in Toronto by Horowitz. I think that's what his name. The guy who did the History of Canada cycle of plays, you know, beginning with the Jesuits and imperialism on the local First Nations. He did a play in 78 or so, and Howard Hughes sitting there, you know, in his hotel, being a hotel hermit, and demanding certain kinds of programming. And it was sort of a comedy, this idea that a wealthy billionaire could do that. But maybe Michael thought they could. Maybe they thought the kind of programs that Michael didn't like were brought in by dummies like Howard Hughes. Anyways, I always remember that image of him manipulating the entertainment for himself. He could buy whole networks and make them make his kind of shows. Well, that's bullshit. And the people rule. The people rule in their own garbage. And I wouldn't say that the entertainment that people like, you know, from AM radio to FM radio, is necessarily ignorant. I mean, Zappa was very democratic about that. He said, if you like the Osmond Brothers and other, you know, mainstream shit, no problem. Just don't keep me off the radio. Let me have my stuff on the radio. Don't be against what I do, you know?
Yeah.
So he was fair about that. And so I'm being fair. I'm not saying I'm not judging the content. You miss the point if you get into arguing over whether content's good or not. I mean, there's lots of good TV in different programming. Now there's so many programs, you can find a couple of good ones that are sophisticated because there's enough audiences to support a show that only gets 2 million or 1 million people watching it, right? But there's interesting ideas put in there. A lot of them use our stuff now to get ideas over the last 10 more years. Let's see. Top-down manipulation. I think top-down should be hyphenated. It's on the grammar level. Part of the trouble with the social platforms is that influential accounts use them primarily to broadcast or speak. So that's producer mania, one way, right? You're just spewing your stuff, rather than listen or engage. Now, a lot of people don't want to engage verbally. They like someone spewing, right? They let, okay, you fill me up. You help me spend time by me listening to what you have to say, like an Alex Jones. I get to type in a comment every now and then in the chat line. And even regular accounts tend to follow this model when they are in a heightened state of emotion. Instead of having conversations, we have shouting matches designed to win. Yeah, but the population is very engaged on the chat line. Look at any major alternative show. It's incredible, the commentary that goes on, the diversity of perspective. And so the people feel that that's pretty safe. I can engage, register something in the chat line, but I don't have any camera looking at me. So the people are really getting their cake and eating it, too. They get all this entertainment, distraction, and they get to hide within it. So we are the guilty people. We are causing the beast. We often talk about how we must touch grass. I've heard several people, one of the women that journalists that Megan interviewed, she said, you know, people should get out and touch the grass. Apparently that's a phrase out there. And distinguish, we talk about how we must touch grass and distinguish the online or media world from the real world. But given how much time we spend plugged in, are they really so separate? So that's a pretty good point, that there is no real world. You're starting to get somewhere there. There's no difference, which was McLuhan's point, that media was nature. Media was the grass. But Carolyn would say, yes, but it's affecting your food. And that is real. And if you don't have your food happening correctly, and you can't get it correct, good food anymore, you got a problem there. You might be having a good time, but you're going to the hospital soon. Might be enjoying a lot of media.
And yeah, you gotta get your nutritional yeast.
Yep. Yeast. The West, though, shake the yeast awake. A line from Vinny Swift.
Yeah.
Okay, you still there, Greg?
I'm here. I just commented.
Oh, on the chat line?
No, I said that I talked about the nutritional yeast.
Oh, wasn't that Brian?
No, it was me.
Nope.
Oh. Okay, missed that, Greg. So, now we get to the meat. Or to the grass. She goes, so what's the solution? You scroll down past the ad there. So she's saying, well, geez, we're living as if the unreal world is real. Well, you know, Baudrillard and everybody over in France in the 70s figured that one out. Not knowing McLuhan had done it. It's amazing what McLuhan is known for, how trivial what he's known for, and the millions of insights he's got. I was looking at, they got a great Wyndham Lewis collection, and there was a C1E review, that's a, you know, literary, sophisticated journal, and Wyndham Lewis did a essay in there that doesn't seem to be that well known among the critics. They missed it. About peace, and how, whether we're going to have peace. This is in 1945, the end of the war. But there's also an article by McLuhan, and the editors don't have McLuhan's name on the front where they name the well-known people, writers who have essays in it. But they don't have McLuhan, so you don't know it. And I didn't know if McLuhan was in it. But I was looking at it the other day, and I said, oh, shit, McLuhan's got something in there. And I think it's an article I never could find, never had. Anyways, he has a bunch of interesting stuff in that situation. I can't even remember. It was very sophisticated what he was writing. You know, the idea itself is, as McLuhan said, one good idea will destroy a lot of people today. He said that back in the 40s and 50s, right? People can't take good ideas. Too complex. So McLuhan comes up with all kinds of them. I'll have to read that essay sometime. I think it's called An Aesthetic Peep Show. Okay, so what's the solution? Okay, Brian, what's the solution? Don't go there yet. What do you say?
Well,
my guru used to say, turn it off. And that's a pretty good answer.
I'll try to come up with something original.
Yes, McLuhan said that no super genius king or queen with their intelligence could affect real change, bring in media ecology. It can't be
right.
Done. You have to get the population to understand it.
You basically have to have the coverage be the vestibule to an institution that tackles the problem rather than just trying to yell at the people with the yell across a canyon at the people with the power to solve it, to just solve it already. I don't know how. And then yell at other people, like, join me in yelling at them to solve it. That it needs to be like an on-ramp to being part of an organization. Like when you're like interviewing someone about their outrageous story,
you know, then instead of just saying, like, donate to their GoFundMe, it's like, follow them as they are now, you know, going to be at least brainstorming to try to solve the problem. I don't know. I'm thinking about the idea that the outrage can be marshaled against things that deserve it. You know, I mean, it's just that you have this, we can't really clearly separate the top down and bottom up in the motivations easily, but you have this terrible tendency where it's a machine that really can educate people, maybe not well, but at least making sure they heard of something. If you give it a couple weeks of sustained outrage stoking on a topic, everybody will have, well, not everybody, whatever, most people, enough people will have ended up at least hearing about that topic. But it's like, the way the machine is designed, the topics that they generate outrage about are the ones that just cut the audience right down the middle, like, and, where it's something that, you know, anyway, like, that's the cynical, it's not the things that everybody could agree that that's outrageous, like, everybody could agree it's outrageous that, you know, shrimp farmers are enslaved on boats that stay out at sea for years at a time, but how do we solve it? Because just no longer buying shrimp won't solve it. Just creating labeling agencies to hire people to go over there and say, like, yep, no slaves in this supply chain, it's been certified, and then paying extra for that stamp, that's not going to solve it. You know, like that, but, you know, that was a big problem, or still is a big problem, and there was a big awareness-raising campaign about it, and that campaign raised awareness, but it didn't, it only solved a local problem where it became too scandalous to try to get away with the exact same thing in that same area, you know, but that business model's too profitable, so it just went elsewhere nearby, but even at the level of raising outrage awareness that they were able to raise, they were only able to sort of move it along out of Thailand into surrounding areas, you know? That apparently the most effective response to it was of, this like organization that was collecting testimony of people who were caught up in these outrages, but not just collecting their testimony, but making them part of an organization that continued to raise awareness and practice a more sustainable model of getting the stuff, you know, so that you have a, so you're not just raising awareness about the problem, but you can also say, like, you can buy our shrimp instead if you want to, like, you know, support people who are survivors of this or something. That, like, that kind of not just raising awareness and then, like, we are the thing, we're the place where you find out what to be outraged about this week, and then next week or tomorrow it'll be a different show and a different topic. When they get on their sustained outrage thing these days, it's on these topics that just divide everybody in half. But when it comes down to, like, slavery and bad food and that kind of thing, like, you know, that should be, like, every other show should be about our food, and, like, and not even just the, you know, that's the food supply, and then there's the food deserts, you know, the outrage, and there's so many people just growing up in places where there's no good food nearby. Like, they are doomed to be horribly unhealthy because there's no fucking good food anywhere within a plausible distance of them. And then, you know, and the same thing will happen to people that are, like, working in the truckers, or, like, working on an oil rig where they're just relying on, like, one restaurant out in the remote place that sucks. You know, like, there are these problems that are, it's problems that are not just, wow, that's outrageous, but they're foundational problems that make everything else worse as well, right? The fact that everybody is malnutritioned all the time, is, like, contributes to the fact that all of our problems don't get solved very well, you know, because we're not, our heads aren't screwed on, we're not operating at optimum or something. So, like, if you focus on the outrages that are nearer the base of the pyramid of the fucking ground, like the quality of our food, like, knowing how media affect our, distort our sensibilities, that kind of thing, the things that affect everything else, and channeling people into
we already have some idea about what to do about it. Is like my best initial guess at how to be less useless. But it's not really a solution because there is no solution. But the real problem is that people enjoy being angry.
Yeah. Okay.
What was your question, Bob?
I just wanted to say this, Brian. There must be 2 million groups of, you know, save us from this, save us from that, support groups. That's a big business, right? People having, save us from multiple sclerosis, specializing. Now, McLuhan said the TV environment was worse than the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb or famine wipes people out, good number of people, but television is here for the next 2,000 years, causing its paralysis of everything.
It's being nuked every day.
Yeah. And so the ground of TV is, so basically all of our problems do come from the screen oil economy, the screen, today. That is causing cancer and everything else that's caused, and even maybe viruses. Part of it is it allows the Big Brother institutes to hide, like the CDC, and make fucking diseases, because there's too much other distraction. So, you get people outraged on a serious issue, but there's a whole bunch of other serious issues that will distract you from the first one that you thought you'd put your attention on. So, okay, looks like Clinton's listening. Clinton emailed me 7 minutes ago and said he has the PDF for another aesthetic peep show. So that's good. You might want to send that around. And then he said the second email 5 minutes ago, the PDF for the Wyndham Lewis article in the C1U review called The Cosmic Uniform of Peace. Those are two good articles. So thank you, Clinton.
No problem.
Send them out to you guys. I think that I never got another aesthetic peep show. Yeah, I may never have found it, but it might have been easily, but maybe the Toronto Libraries didn't have the C1E review back in 45 or something, but to me, it doesn't sound familiar. When I started to read it, McLuhan's article on the aesthetic peep show, it seemed due to me. So anyways, but Clinton has access to stuff, so he's got it there. All right, so Greg, go ahead. You wanted to say something.
No, what was your question there? You asked a question.
So what's the solution?
Oh, okay. To what?
Yeah, you were going to say something. I cut you off.
No, I was wondering, like, it seemed like you asked a question, and then there was this, I guess, Brian would answer your question. But then I lost
my
question.
I rambled, and my ramble was answering just, you know, before we go to what this author says is the solution, what do I think is the solution?
Oh, Greg, you're saying Brian answered your question?
No. I got confused as to what the question was.
I think I went on so long he forgot what the question was.
Yeah, I heard a question, and then Brian started to guess answer the question, and that went on for about, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 minutes, and then I lost what you were asking.
Well, I think what I asked was, what's the solution? And Brian says there is no solution. I don't know if I agree with that, but let's see what she says.
There's going to be a demand for outrage. I figure like any solution is going to have to address this question of we're going to have to like have surgery at birth to remove the gland that makes us like getting angry at stuff, other stuff just as much as we like opiates or whatever.
Just so we can stop the guys making money. You know, there's a critic out now, she calls herself a feminist, who's exposing the huge profits being made out of the transgender altering of people. It's a huge fucking business. Probably owned by Microsoft. If you remember that point that the Dominion suit, $780 million they are going to get out of Fox, and it turns out both Fox and, Dominion are owned by BlackRock and maybe Vanguard. So BlackRock is paying another part of itself, the other stuff, and you'll use that for tax deduction. Right? The expense.
Yeah, there's a
fine.
Yeah, it's not so much that Dominion is suing Fox so much as one of BlackRock's balance sheets is suing another one of BlackRock's balance sheets.
Yeah. They need that expense. They need the deduction. So.
Yeah, I need to be balanced. Make me whole.
Now, the Mobius strip of this situation, economically and politically, I guess, in the bureaucratic sense of politics, feeds on itself. That is more and more possible once TV came in and then the computerization and digitizing. We're so entwined among each other that now you begin to look at Finnegan's Wake and understand why it's written. It's a painting of the way we actually are. We're subatomic. We're involved with each other and beyond any demarcation, so that today the big scandal is the AI, nobody knows where it's coming from and who's making it. And those that are supposed to know don't admit they don't know. That's how involved we are. We're navel-gazing, right? And we're so navel-gazing, we turn out to be a million parts of ourselves, are navel-gazing ourselves. Or there are a million versions of Brian or Greg or me. And it's all looking at itself. So then you get into modern art.
It's strange. It's almost like the now I'm reminded of the entanglement or the non-local entanglement idea, that particles that interact somewhere and then separate are still, you know, one of them leaves the interaction positive and the other leaves the interaction negative, that if you can somehow artificially switch the charge on one of them, the charge will automatically change on the other one, even if they're now far apart. Because they're entangled and they have to be the opposite now, or they have to be the same or something like that.
Yeah.
Now that's reminding me of this. It's almost like that's the mentality of the people who just can't change their mind on an issue because it's on any issue because it's just, they're just entangled with the people on their side of the culture war. And so they're just like, well, I just accept the charge that all the people I've been entangled with in the past assigned to me, because if I was to suddenly, it's as if like I can't change my charge, there's so much gravity of all the other charges I've ever been involved with in my life would have to change. I don't know, I'm just thinking, rambling.
Yeah, but if it's so entangled, okay, I have this point of view, but I also have the opposite point of view. That's implied, the more I understand the entanglement of everything. So what we're saying, this response to Catherine Brodsky's column, should be mandatory seminars on this, what we're going to say, what we're going to do. We're wrapping up. We're indicating the basics that everybody should learn. It's the new language they should learn, the new grammar, not a particular literate language. So let's see if I can prove that with the end here. So Catherine says, so what's the solution? What's the antidote to the industrial outrage complex? Now she says, the problem is complex and multifaceted. Now, that's what everybody admits and usually stops at that point. It's too complex. But she says, there are some things we can do. As they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first step is admitting that we have a problem. So let's go ahead and admit it. It's just one little voice among 2 quadrillion voices saying, hey, let's admit it. Let's listen to me. So let's go ahead and admit it. We have a problem. So now, let's find the courage and wisdom to change the things we can, So I guess this is what we can change. This means being more critical of the information that we consume and more skeptical of the motivations behind it. More repeating of cliches. Everybody is critical and everybody knows it's for money. Okay, so nothing new there. We should be asking ourselves why a particular piece of content is being presented to us. Well, why? Ask about anything. There's so much presented to us. Where do we begin? And she says, we should be asking ourselves why a particular piece of content is being presented to us and what the agenda of the person or organization behind it might be. Is the problem being highlighted really as critical and important to the lives of individuals as it's being presented? Or is it designed to maximize a certain reaction? If we get this broadcast we're doing out there and it becomes standard Esperanto for everybody to learn, I'm sorry, Catherine's going to be the Liz Cheney of it all. She's going to be the person who wrote the final column that repeated every other column before the change, the great change brought in by our show, Office Hours. Because these aren't going to do anything to anybody, right? Now, it's embarrassing that she gets away to write such simple, stupid stuff. You know, nobody can, the humanist ideas, we should calm down, we should contemplate, they can't be implemented in our lives under these conditions. Nobody can live like that way. Unless they're an old person, senile, watching Fox or something, they could get an occasional thought to do something like this. But listen, Catherine, this is disgustingly bland. So let's see. She says, it's important for us to slow down when we engage with content that provokes emotional reactions within us. We don't even know what fucking thing is an emotional reaction anymore is. Consider why it gets us so upset. When you understand the entanglement of everything, our definitions of nouns don't work. We don't know what emotional reactions are. We've gotten so used to, you know, the frog thing, the boiling frog, the frog being boiled. We don't know what is standards. I just know that people who lived 100 years ago, if they lived today, they would die pretty quickly from the shock of human expression. Consider why it gets us so upset. Take some time to process it and not respond as quickly. Slowing things down allows us to think over our emotions and not be slaves to them. You know, I don't think Catherine has these kind of thoughts very much. She's too busy living her life as a journalist and commentator and writing things and forgot these basics. And every 5 years, the basics come back to her, so she thinks, oh, we all forgot this. And she's writing out something that she hadn't thought about for a while.
Yeah.
Why doesn't she repeat this column every fucking week from now on?
Well, I mean, it's basics, too. It's basic enough that it's not beyond the, it wouldn't even be like a significant advance over what's available in the mainstream, because it's kind of just media literacy and mindfulness is basically what she's saying the solution is. I mean, I guess slowing down everything and is related to mindfulness anyway. And then just the other, like, ask yourself, you know, what their agenda is. Yeah, you know, that's like a kind of a basic thing too, but it's like, yeah, these aren't, if it's a new problem, then these old solutions are not likely to really be the solution. Oh, they might have, they'll help. I'm not saying it's bad advice, but it's not a solution.
Yeah, Daniel Schmachtenberger column where he explained how AI has got to the point now when no one knows where it is, how it's being made, and I read that, his dialogue with some woman, last week, and then the next day, the guy who invented AI, who now is at the University of Toronto, has quit and says, I've created a monster. That's today's headline. I created a monster. And he says, my life work was bullshit. And he's repenting. Well, he'd be able to stop it.
Not bullshit, but like, you know, not a good idea. Unwise.
Well, he says he regrets it. And then you would add to that, well, he wasted his time. And he wasted time on bullshit. Trying to create something that he thought would improve situations. Turned out wrong. As Catherine said, you don't need to get into the bullshit to find out what the bull ate. And, you know, you talk to anybody on the street, talk to your bus driver. They'll just say, it's all about money. And that's it. There's no thought. There's no more to thinking about it. It's almost like an icon of realm of knowledge. You just sum up with those words. Look, it's always about money. And that sums up everything for a lot of people. It isn't all about money. It's beyond that now. But that cliche is not valid. So, to be a column like this, should be. We're demanding better work from you, Catherine. Let's see. Slowing things down allows us to think over our emotions and not be slaves to them. Ever try to not be a slave to your emotions? Not many people can do that. Not many people can ignore their emotions. Good, bad, or indifferent. They have emotions. They're run by them all the time. Their thinking is run by emotions. It's life. It's oxygen. Before posting a response or sharing thoughts, also consider this. Why do you want to share them? Why do you hope to bring or add to the, what do you hope to bring or add to the conversation? What do you want to accomplish? Is there anything you'd like to learn? What's going to be the most useful response in serving your goals? Just asking yourself these questions will make a significant difference. Now, if we realize that we didn't need to eat, can you get somebody, if they accept it, yeah, it's been proven. We eat, we live on such non-nutritious food today that it shows you your bodies don't need food to live. They don't need nutrition. They can live regardless of that. Now, that's a weird thing for people to believe. But anyway, look at this. We're talking about information, and it's food. So she's asking us, why do you want to eat some food? Why do you want to share it? What do you hope to accomplish by eating?
Yeah, yeah.
Is there something you'd like to use with your feces and flower the garden with? What's going to be the most useful response in serving your hunger? Just asking yourself these questions will make a significant difference.
Yeah.
I can't believe. Imagine typing this, Greg. Imagine writing this. No. And this person probably is a successful journalist and highly paid. Well, I have to look at, okay, so you look at, she's written all kinds of other great columns and great issues and brought attention to a lot of things. Well, what prompted her to write this? That's a lapse. Don't write this kind of column. That has nothing to do with what you're doing as a journalist.
Desperation.
What's that? That sounds like Clinton.
It's Clinton.
What caused her to write it?
It's a special guest.
Hey, Clinton, how you doing, Clinton?
Doing great, guys. Been listening.
Yeah, welcome.
And do you like what we're talking about, Clinton?
I do. I was just enjoying it. Yep, sitting back. You guys can meet up.
There's like a... There's like a lurking, you know, a background agenda that could flare up at any time that, you know, we're going to fight a war on disinformation or something. I mean, obviously we are a little bit already, but, you know, the next war on terror or war on the common cold might be, you know, war on online commentary or something like that. So it'll always be, you know, if you don't know what the fuck to write about, it'll always be like, well, they're always looking for more, you know, just keep that song going of like, actually, one big concern that could turn into society's biggest menace is people being pissed off online all the time.
So what did Clinton say? You said a word, Clinton, when I heard your voice.
Desperation. You asked, so why did she write this? And I said, desperation.
You know, when I first saw this posted, Clinton, I looked at that name. I said, oh, this is Clinton's boss. This is Clinton's lady. And then I looked closely at the name, and I thought, no. I think your friend is Catherine also, isn't she?
Yes.
Yeah, I was about to be horrified if that was the case.
What's her last name? Like her. You're Catherine.
Catherine D.
D, right. So I thought, oh, this is Catherine. This will be interesting. What has Clinton taught her? But it wasn't her. It's Brodsky. And then she's nowhere near this, so I'm going to send this to Brodsky. But you got to, now that you're in on this, Clinton, you got to give this to D. She got to hear this. I don't know if she might know it, having talked to you or something, but we're getting to the bases, aren't we, Clinton?
I liked your observation earlier, but it was about half an hour ago, you said, you know, it's like, oh, you know, she's analyzing it from, you know, well, what I remember is it's something like you said, she's analyzing it from an economic framework, which is what everyone's doing. And that's really what the problem is for me, is that everyone goes to school and they learn an economic framework by which to analyze the whole world, or they learn a sociological framework, right? Or or they learn this narrative style of... Everything's a story, and you know, all of our letter, we run on stories. We're the animal that lives in stories, right? And that defines these people, right? And the idea of the material, artificial, second nature environment be having a history of and of itself, and it being the complementary extension of our bodies that we wield and or are puppeted around by. That perspective has got no voice whatsoever, and it never will, apparently, if we continue to allow inertia to allow these conversations to drift in the same familiar directions, because people don't want to be taught something that isn't already 90% within a framework they already feel very proud to have learned for the last 20, 30 years of their lives, right? So if you can't explain to them the way Marx would, and then they look at you like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? Haven't you read anything? Haven't you read anything?
Why hey, Clint, I got an idea.
Extract capitalism, or why don't you talk about, you know...
You know this idea...
Just one more point,
Bob.
Okay,
finish your sentence. Say your last point. What is it?
They always reach for Neoplatonism as an answer to some sort of transcendence. You have to transcend these problems and get to the point to be.
No, you don't have to transcend, Clinton. You have to ascend.
Ascend.
Yeah, I love that's another ass end.
Ass
the
ass end. Yeah, that's what Ion talks about. That's what he preaches. Ass ending.
Okay, so Clinton, it just occurred to me, McLuhan's thing of bad news sells good news. That bad news, good news thing, ads versus doom news, doom information. Oh, yeah. They say that the internet made people go more into bubbles of what they already knew or understood or agreed with. That's a variation on avoiding advertising, which today is new information stories, new patterns that titillate the mind. There's too much of it, so we block it by going into the bad news syndrome, which is tell me what I know and remind me of what I know, because I'm being constantly threatened to disrupt what I know with new stuff to know. That's a new wrinkle to the advertising explanation that McLuhan had about news. That just occurred to me. A new wrinkle.
All right. Unfortunately, I'm in and out, but good talk, guys. I enjoyed listening to it, and I'll catch up on the last 10 minutes on the recording, okay?
Yeah, and we'll send it to Miss D. Miss D will get this.
All right, do it.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll finish.
That'd be funny. All right.
Yeah. Bye. Well, at least you were here. That's our alibi. We got 10 minutes. So to finish up, we're at the point where she's asking about whether you should eat or not, and how you should speculate on whether you should eat or not. At the end of the day, now there is no day. No end, 24/7 virtual simulation, you know, that's a silly phrase. No thought, as McLuhan would say, no thinking going on here. At the end of the day, our politicians, algorithm is the new name for a controllable AI or tech body. It's actually beyond that, maybe. Algorithms and media, our politicians, algorithms and media outlets are reflections of us to an extent, our best and our worst. We need to learn how to engage differently. We need to expect more. That doesn't work. Engage differently. What would be really different would be to have a 3-week turnoff of the media, of a lot of it. That would be different. We need to expect more. No, there's no time. There's no audience. Who's listening to it? They must rely on cliche. We need to push back against politicians who use outrage as a political tool. Well, that's everybody. And support those who are willing to engage in thoughtful, constructive debate. Now, Greg's definition of outrage is not the same as hers. She's got outrage as emotional laziness. Greg says, no, outrage is good. We just need to mobilize it better. And support
I wonder
really...
whether I just
I think what I'm
I
saying
get
is
the, I suspect that her definition of outrage has a distinct political bias built into it about which kind of politicians use outrage and which don't.
Yeah.
I think would she when she you know, would she include Justin Trudeau, like, ranting, like, yelling about people putting their fellow Canadians in danger by being unvaccinated on a train? As an example of using outrage, or no?
That was the question?
I wonder whether she would, maybe I'm just assuming, but I'm guessing that she would probably identify, pushing back on politicians who use outrage as a tool is like, she's probably has a few, you know, conservative leaning, you might say, faces that leap to mind. But I wonder, you know, whether she would exhibit marked hesitancy when asked about, flagrant examples of using outrage as a tool from popular politicians of the quote left center.
Right. So the entanglement, the Mobius strip of feeding off ourselves, the icon of that, the one thing everybody would demand commentary on is Mr. Donald Trump. Your opinion of Donald
right.
Trump, good or bad, is not how you should analyze Trump. You know, I was just thinking that politics ignores the economic ground. He's the first guy who came, the myth about him is he came out of the economic ground and disrupted politics because he was a billionaire
right.
businessman who didn't have to play the game. So maybe that was new. 19th century, apparently the rich people ran the politics, but whatever it is, we got into a situation with our software communism environment, to quote McLuhan, everybody's a super angel. The actual businessmen showed up to change the political thing. So I think the test for everybody is what they say about the Trump phenomenon. And there's a correct answer. Not on a value judgment level. And so, yeah, she might think that Trump is a politician who uses outrage, but she may not. That is the question. It's that simple now. Media ecology is about Trump. Okay, so that's my little twist there in response to you, Brian. Let's see. We have to support those who do thoughtful, constructive debate. Well, that goes on 24/7 on all the quiet C-SPAN talk shows.
What does she mean, support?
Yeah,
what
how do you support
them? Support
that's a good point. Yeah, we've got to say cheer.
Platform them or something? Give
say
them
that's
money?
The only thing we listen to? We only watch those shows. This is so naive. It's silly.
Say, like, on Tucker Carlson tonight, let me take you through an exemplary Twitter thread where people debated something civilly and with nuance.
You're saying that's what Tucker does?
Or you could. Like, it's like, what, we should be, instead of, we should be platforming the people who, the people who are, like you're saying, those dialogues are happening. So what do? We like, take them and cover them on the big shows? Oh, great, like, that's news. Like, a really good conversation happened in Facebook comment thread today.
Right. We
yeah,
need to move away
idea.
From the personalities, that's in quote, personalities who seek to enrage us. Talk about look at The View, and work to balance the content we view on social media and traditional media so that we're not always responding to negative outrage content, but are also inviting positive, uplifting, thoughtful, nuanced, educational content. We don't know what any of those refer to anymore. What's uplifting? Educational content of substance. Inviting this substance into our lives. Oh, look, we get to the food metaphor that I brought up. She ends by saying, ever heard the phrase, you are what you eat? Well, the same applies here. We need to become master curators. Do not feed the trolls. Well, I think Catherine is one of the major trolls of our time, and we need to make a new story out of her incompetent column. This debate is what she's asking for. Thoughtful debate. Now I have nothing against Catherine personally. Not talking personally, but what she writes, what she's doing, and I'm engaging a thoughtful debate about it. Aren't I? Isn't that what I'm doing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, we always pick the best.
Wise a little bit, but, you know, we're trying to be sincere and have a debate and be charitable.
Well, the debate is whether this article is absolutely terrible and should never have been printed.
That's right. That's a valid angle. In her picture, her photo of herself, I think that's her at the bottom. She's quoting Marcel Duchamp. You know, Andy Warhol used to always, when people came to the factory in the mid-60s, he would tape them in front of the camera, and they would have to just look at the camera, try to outstare the camera. So Duchamp, he just kept looking off to the side. His eyes were going back and forth. He didn't stare. He looked suspiciously to the border of the camera. Well, that's what she's doing. She has a picture of herself, and she's looking off to the side, kind of paranoid. Or maybe she's pretending she's looking at what is being missed. Maybe she means that in a Duchamp-y way. But
all the way through it, she's trying to direct you to a subject, to a personality, or to a person, but without mentioning them.
Directing us to a wise person? Is that what you're saying?
She's getting us to read between the lines. Instead of saying what she finds offensive she doesn't want to say that she finds certain things offensive because then she'd be part of the problem that she's discussing. She doesn't want to say, well, I don't like this kind of person or this kind of thing and mention it specifically. She then says, well, we shouldn't have this kind of thing. We should have that kind of thing. But she doesn't even mention that.
Yeah, it'd be difficult for her to specify. It would be professionally a problem to be show favoritism. So, yeah, she's asking us to do something we can't do, and she can't guide us in it.
No.
Good point there, Greg.
Thank you.
Now she will, once she hears this. So thank you
How
for...
How would she hear this?
Yeah.
What'd
How
you say, Greg? I'm
How
sending it to
it?
Her.
Do you know her?
It's going to end any second, Greg. So I just want to thank Catherine for hearing us out.
Do you know her?
On our show, you can debate us, argue us. Let's invite her on, man. Okay, so if there are any more shows, it is the week of nuclear Garmageddon and everything. We may not have any more shows, Catherine.